We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Annalise Henzel with this week's inquiry. It centers on a weekend brunch staple, the Bloody Mary. The vodka and tomato juice drink has become known for its garnishes, which tower over other cocktails.
There's a Brussels sprout, there was asparagus, there's shrimp.
Of course, the celery heart, just for the looks.
Today there's going to be a piece of brisket in it, actually.
And if you order a Bloody Mary in Wisconsin, there's something else that sets it apart, the beer chaser. Bubbler Talk listener Susie noted she's only seen it served here. She's not alone in the observation.
We were literally just talking about this.
I met David Sage of New Berlin last weekend at Sobelman's Pub and Grill in the Menominee Valley. He was having brunch with his friend Allie Borchers, who was visiting.
I'm from Iowa, and I've never had a beer chaser after a Bloody Mary.
Borchers says she wasn't sure how to react when she ordered a Bloody Mary at Sobelman's and also got a small beer.
They're like, oh, here you go. And I said, is this normal? And he looked at me like I was crazy.
Borchers sipped just a tiny bit of the chaser, uncertain about the tradition, but Sage imbibed his.
So my argument for the chaser is it cuts a little bit of the savory down with a little bit of bitter.
Sobelman's owner, Dave Sobelman, agrees the flavors make a good fit, but he admits he is not sure why people began serving the drinks together.
Best I can come up with it, it's just a part of our culture.
Sobelman says Milwaukee is America's beer capital, and small glasses of beer, the size of the chasers he serves, have been around for decades. When he was a kid, people in neighborhood taverns nursed them.
And there'd be men who are retired. And you just sit at the corner bar, you drink your tiny glass of beer, you're sipping on it for hours while you're watching Hawaii Five-0, whatever they would watch, the Honeymooners.
Sobelman guesses at some point someone realized a small glass of beer would go nicely with a Bloody Mary. Matt Langer shared his thoughts on the chaser's origin while preparing a Bloody Mary at the White House in Bayview.
It's always got to be shaken.
Langer says for years, Wisconsin drinkers have ordered a shot and a beer, using the beer to chase the liquor.
It's kind of like the water back when you order something neat or on the rocks, like a bourbon. It's standard to hand a small side of water with it, too, just to kind of, you know, wash the burn down.
Solanger says when the Bloody Mary arrived on the scene, it must have occurred to someone that beer would do a good job chasing the thick, spicy drink. Historian Jim Drager confirms chasers were established before the 1950s when Bloody Marys began to catch on. He's co-author of Bottoms Up, a toast to Wisconsin's historic bars and breweries.
You can certainly find chasers in Minnesota, parts of Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, but kind of the heart of the chaser is in Wisconsin.
And do you have any sense of why that is?
Tradition and custom, I would say, would be the answer to that. You know, some things are just because they are.
Drager says while chasers in general are regional, he believes the Bloody Mary beer chaser is most often found in this state. Yet while it's well-loved among fans, Drager believes the tradition is dying out.
The Bloody Mary itself is getting more ambitious. There's a lot more attention paid to the garnish, so in some ways the garnish is starting to replace the chaser, I think.
As far as beer lovers such as Chris Ranson are concerned, what matters is not the prevalence of the chaser, but rather its quality. She's with Lakefront Brewery in Milwaukee.
The beer should accent that Bloody Mary flavor, and if you have something that doesn't do that, then might as well not have it.
Bubbler Talk is a production of WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Do you have a question about our city that you've always wanted answered? Submit it online at WUWM.com and maybe we'll quench your thirst for knowledge.
You can, of course, hear Bubbler Talk each week, Fridays on Lake Effect and on Morning Edition right here on WUWM. And Bonnie North is with me in the studio right now. And I think this is our first on-air membership drive since Bubbler Talk launched, which—
I believe you're absolutely right.
And so it's worth noting that Bubbler Talk is something that that a lot of people have become very fond of in just its short run on the air. It's a great way for people to share what's on their mind and what they've always wanted to know about the city they might have lived in all their lives, or they might have moved to in more recent times. It's another reason why Lake Effect is unique among its peer shows. I don't think we have any peer shows.
But, I really don't think so. This is so different than just about any other thing out there on the public radio landscape. And the fact that we have basically an hour a day to talk about all of these interesting things, people doing interesting things in our community, artists making great art, scientists doing what they do, and we get to talk to politicians and newsmakers, and it's a long-form thing where you get to hear a little more than you would in a 2 or 3 minute piece on, you know, on a news show. So, you know, it's one of those things that we know you love it because you write to us and tell us that you do. And so now is the time to show some financial love to Lake Effect. You do that by calling 414-227-3210 or going to wuwm.com/give.
And this is really your last opportunity to voice your support for Lake Effect and help us reach our goal of $700 this hour. We are inching ever closer to that goal.
For the past 6 years, the Milwaukee Rep has kicked off their main stage season with a large-scale musical, with productions ranging in style from Cabaret to The Color Purple to Assassins to Next to Normal. Well, area audiences have come to expect something sweeping as well as tuneful as the company's season gets underway.
This year is no exception. Man of La Mancha opens tomorrow evening on the Quadracci Powerhouse stage. It premiered on Broadway in 1964 and won 5 Tony Awards. It is a Don Quixote story retold, and it gave the world The Impossible Dream, one of the most recognizable musical theater songs of all time.
Director Mark Clements and movement and fight director James Zager joined me recently in the studio to talk about the staging of this iconic piece, and Zager explained how he came on board.
When Mark approached me about this originally, we talked about it specifically that he didn't want a choreographer. He wanted a movement specialist because he wanted everything to kind of grow out of natural movement for the prisoners for the time, since the conceit is that they are creating the show in the prison and a lot of it is improvised by prisoners who are participating. So a great deal of what I've been doing, I've also been doing a lot of the physical violence, but a great deal of what I've been doing is helping people move in a way that isn't contemporary. But also we were looking at a world of what I call pre-flamenco, because this is the roots of flamenco are here. So looking at bullfighting and the pride of the body, which is open and out, as opposed to the prisoner's body that's rounded. And then, like we were talking about in tech, a lot of it is moving 22 people as quickly as possible so that when a moment happens, we have to have all this action, but we also have to have a traffic pattern for 20 people so we don't have 3 minutes go by while a trunk gets dragged down. So I'm doing a lot of that kind of visualization. I made a joke yesterday in tech that if everyone could just crawl into my head and know where they should go, we would save a lot of time. But I have to sort of go to each person and go, you go here, and when that person crosses, that's your path through here.
So you're almost, in this case, right now, being a traffic cop.
Oh, absolutely.
Trying to get those patterns moving.
Actually, one of the things I fell into yesterday was we had one moment where they actually did it too well, and I had to remind them that they don't really know where they're going. So they do have to have, as actors, they have to have their safe path. But as prisoners, it has to look like a reaction. So it has to be you're moving because someone else is coming toward you and you're running away from this person. If it's too clean, then it doesn't ring true because it looks too rehearsed. So we have to have it safe and rehearsed without actually looking rehearsed. I think that's really a lot of what we keep looking at.
Mm. Mark, I wanted to talk about the choice of La Mancha in general. It is part of the American canon of musical theater pieces. I don't think I have ever seen it fully performed.
It sort of goes in little spates of, you know, you see a few productions happening and then it dies down and then people find it again. It's a really interesting piece, you know, in that Miguel de Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote de la Mancha, the premises that he comes into the prison, invents himself basically to save his life against these sort of cutthroat murderers and thieves in the jail, puts on a play as part of his defense about why he should stay alive before the Inquisition get hold of him. So the stakes are high for him from the beginning, and then he becomes Alonso de Quiana, who then becomes Don Quixote de la Mancha, about a man who is in his sort of late middle age, who is kind of just read about all these terrible things that are going on in the world and suddenly feels that he needs to become an activist, for want of a better word.
And he's actually sort of compelled.
Yeah, yeah, and go out to right the wrongs and to uphold chivalry and be kind to women and animals and the world. So really, and I think the three authors, you know, back in the day, and of course the piece is, you know, 54, 55 years old now. And usually why these pieces are endure is for very good reason. You know, they have something thematically about them that is still has a resonance with people apart from wonderful music. And of course, everybody knows the song The Impossible Dream, probably maybe one of the most covered songs in the world. And everybody knows that song. But actually, the lyrics of that song, when we read it at the read-through, it just really resonated in such a powerful way. You know, so much about, you know, how we live our lives right now, living in the present. We don't have a tomorrow, so we don't know. So we have to live in the now. That's all we have. And it's the hardest lesson for us to learn because we assume there's always going to be plenty of time, and often there isn't, and we don't know. And I think he embraces that very well and tries to instill that type of thinking and culture within his fellow prisoners. It's kind of really interesting how art can touch people who we think are beyond redemption and actually are too far kind of in the dark side of the world, and actually how art can turn those people around. And so I think thematically it's a very interesting way, almost like a Brechtian kind of conceit in some ways, where the audience are asked to, you know, suspend their disbelief and just enter into the world.
Yeah, be part of it, exactly. Yeah, that wall is broken.
Yeah, he says right at the beginning, I'm going to ask you to imagine that I'm a knight errant, and you'll enter into this world with me, and you'll see things that maybe as and when you're ready to see, and let your imagination run rife, you know, and go on this journey of purity with me. And you know, take some of them longer to do that than others.
And as is true in anything in life, you can never stay in that place.
No,
you might achieve that moment, but then
the impossible dream,
the impossible. And even in the piece, it's multi-layered, because we have the prisoners, we have the world of the play that's being done for the prisoners, and we have this Inquisition, and they intrude in on the play in that sense. The play hits a point where it's we're watching the play within the play. You almost forget about the fact that it's being done in a prison. You are now buying into this whole thing. And right at that moment, we hear the Inquisition come back, and they come in to put the question to someone. And it is a test for not just Don Quixote, right, but for Cervantes. He's asked, are you afraid? Where's your knight now? To answer to the Inquisition. And he chooses to go back to the story. He chooses to go back to this world where you can dream an impossible dream. And I think it's so powerful, because I think about this play all the time, about being about choices that people make, and how the human spirit to choose to go back to that dream, even though everything around you is telling you not to. I think it's a beautiful message for where we are in the world right now.
And what do we do if we don't make that dream? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the things that keep us alive? Is dreaming and being, you know, one of the things that we've talked about quite a lot in rehearsal is, you know, what is Alonso Quixana's state of mind? It would probably be, in this day and age, would be diagnosed as Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's this whole debate. What do we do with Alzheimer patients, you know, depending on how advanced the disease is, but do we try to correct them? You know, if they're living in a blissful sense of fantasy, I mean, sometimes they're not. They're living in a state of panic and confusion and can't get out of that. And that's the terrible part of it. But sometimes people are, you know, they're very happy believing that the husband or the wife they lost 20 years ago is still alive and they're in that world. And is it such an important thing to snap them out of that? And actually, how important is it to allow people to be dreamers? When does that become a danger to other people? Or when is it absolutely harmless? And should we actually let people just be happy? And I think the play analyzes that all the way through.
Well, and who gets to dictate what reality is?
Right.
And who gets to say what is going to be harmful and what isn't?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like it's not only one person's choice, it's everybody's choice, and how they all – it goes back to almost what you were saying, James, about trying to just do the traffic pattern. We're all trying to do that.
Right.
We're all trying to figure out how not to crash into each other.
Yeah, and the prisoners – are so important. It's not just an ensemble on stage, but their point of view is so important. Mark spent a great deal, like 4 or 5 days at the beginning of the rehearsal process doing table work. And also, I just have to point out that you continually refer to the play, which is great. Not the musical, but the play. There's it's such an important play here, in addition to all the great music. But that what we watch as an audience are these prisoners, and when do they make a choice? When do they choose to buy into the hope and the story? When does their cynicism go away? And so they are present. Mark has kept them present even longer than any production I've ever seen, keeps the prisoners there so that we can continue to look at the events on stage through their eyes as we get to know them.
One of the challenges is that you've got 2 or 3 characters with a lot of backstory and a lot of lines to give their reason, you know, for why they're doing what they're doing. But they've also got, in our case, 22, 23 actors on stage. Some people have no lines, some people who have to respond in the moment. And every single second has to have a point of view from somebody. They have to track it through. I always do backstories, you know, what are the things we know about a character? What are the things we don't know about them? What are the assumptions, reasonable assumptions we could make about them? Where do they come from? I pretty much do that on everything now, just so that everybody is in the same play, because I think this is the hardest part of this thing. I actually think what I was reflecting on this, I think this is the hardest musical I've ever had to direct.
Mm-hmm.
Not in terms of, you know, size or amount of people on stage or any of that stuff, but just finding what do you want the audience to feel at this moment in time? Because sometimes there is no definitive answer to that. And it's just one of those pieces that if we get it right, that has people getting the Kleenex out 3/4 of the way into the play and not fully being able to articulate why.
Mm-hmm.
And the music is extremely beautiful and manipulative, in a way that almost like operatic in some ways, but, a Puccini kind of way where mm-hmm. you don't know why you're crying just because the music makes you weep. But of course, there is that very manipulative element there. But I think it transcends that as well. It's just this investment in these kind of group of misfit people and feeling things that you wouldn't expect to feel. This piece has the potential to do that if you get it right. And why I think it's a piece that's still being done nearly 60 years from when it was first produced.
Well, I am so looking forward to seeing it. So looking forward to seeing it. I want to thank you guys. My pleasure to have you in the studio again.
Pleasure
yes,
to be here.
It's wonderful.
Mark Clements is the artistic director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. He also directed the musical Man of La Mancha, which opens tomorrow night at the Quadracci Powerhouse Stage. James Zager is the production's movement director. There is more information at WUWM.com, including some production photos. That wraps up Lake Effect today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski. We also get additional support from Mayan Silver.
Our education reporter is Rachel Morello, and Susan Bentz covers the environment. We get web and social media support from Michelle Maternowski, and our engineer is John Strelecki.
Do join us for more stories on Lake Effect Weekend, which airs Saturday and Sunday at 3, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock, but Mitch, one more time, what's that number?
414-227-3210, or stop by our website, wuwm.com/give. And thank you so much.